The Athletic.
Totally Football Show.
Today, moving on up, moving on out in the Champions League. Who's looking like leaders? Whose performance was worthy of the conference? Plus, a whopping weekend in the Premier League. We talk fixture times, your pick of the kickoffs, creepy gloves, how many Gunnosauras, and much, much more in this Totally Football Show. Thursday the 6th of October. Welcome, listener, to this Totally Football Show. Looking forward to this. We've got Duncan Alexander with us. Hey, Duncan.
Hey, James.
Also, Jack Lang returning. Hello, Jack.
Hi, James.
And Michael Cox. Michael.
Hi, James.
Hello to you all. And hello, listener. Today's the day, 6th of October, that the Totally Football book is out. They say don't judge a book by its cover, but you could do worse because it's got a lovely cover. Lovely cover. Somebody compared it to Dazzle Ships, the seminal Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark OMD album from back in the day. But yeah, it's some pretty interesting.
More like OMG when you read the content.
Thanks, Duncan. What kind of content would people be reading in there, Duncan?
I did a thing using numbers, obviously, to work out the most average player. Not worst, but average player in the Premier League last season. So. Right. It's a fun journey to a, you know, hopefully exciting slash unusual destination.
Absolutely. And there's all your favourites from the Athletic. Stellar stable of sports writers in the Totally Football book. Anyway, super. For us today, we're going to be talking about round 10 of the Premier League season. It features Liverpool, Arsenal and whatever Haaland and company do to Southampton. But shall we begin with the Champions League, which was rocking our world on Tuesday and Wednesday evening? What caught your eye? Was it the fact that the only two teams yet to drop points or even concede a goal are Bayern Munich and Bruges? Bruges, you beat Atletico Madrid 2-0. Woof. Was it perhaps Inter manager Simone Inzaghi with that meme-tastic we've been busted sideways glance? When VAR were checking that handball shout for the Barcelona penalty, which, you know, bizarrely they decided actually was totally fine and handle away, Dumfries. Yeah.
That sounds like a Proclaimers song. It's good.
Handle away, Dumfries.
Yeah.
Was it big wins for Premier League sides mostly? Liverpool 2-0 against Rangers, Man City 5-0 against Copenhagen, and perhaps most impressively, Chelsea 3-0 against group leaders Milan, Spurs only managing a 0-0 at Frankfurt. Or was it perhaps, he said, moving on, Napoli winning 6-1 at Ajax? Was it that?
C'è il Napoli però in avanti che va a realizzare il sesto gol con Simeone. Simeone, il marchio, il segno del Ciolito al 36esimo nella ripresa, Ajax 1, Napoli 6.
Yeah, I think that was a standout win. I mean, I've seen a few 6-1s before. I can't remember many 6-1s where the losing side go 1-0 ahead. So that was particularly exciting. And yeah, for Napoli to be top of that group, plus 11 goal difference. I mean, they've absolutely battered all three teams they've played. I believe James Horncastle claims they're the most exciting side in Europe at the moment.
Playing the best football in Europe.
Okay, yeah, near enough. Yeah, I think on the basis of that performance, I'd have to go along with that. I mean, they are just playing fantastic football. And football that feels quite typical of their manager as well, of Spalletti. I mean, I think it was the third goal they scored last night with Zielinski running through when Raspadori came short and then he had four players bursting past him. Reminded me a lot of his Roma side, reminded me a bit of his Zenit side. And yeah, it was great to see. They're a really, really exciting team. And that's not an easy group. I mean, Liverpool and Ajax in the same group, but they're absolutely breezing it.
Yeah, it's surprising as well. Very much at the start of the season, the narrative was about how many players Napoli had lost, spine of their team and all that. Koulibaly going to Chelsea. Kim's been a wonderful replacement. But up front, Dries Mertens, who's kind of the soul of the team, and an Insigne, an emblemic player. But I wonder if Insigne moving on has just taken a whole load of baggage away, that the refreshing of their squad has has just lifted a lot of the maybe some of the issues that were hanging over that team in terms of underperformance in past seasons. They certainly seem to be playing with wonderful abandon. Ajax, meantime, absolutely smashed in that game. The previous biggest number of goals they'd ever conceded in a home game in European football was 4-6 in this one. And a season that had started so brightly for them is looking a lot less shiny right now.
Yeah, it was their biggest margin of defeat since losing to Feyenoord in the 1960s. So it is pretty much unprecedented in the modern era. And Napoli, the first Italian team to score 6 or more goals in Champions League games since Juventus back in 2003, which is obviously an entirely different era. So it's a statement wins go. That is up there.
Certainly was. What else caught your eye, Jack Lang, midweek?
Well, Sporting goalkeeper Anthony Adan with perhaps like the worst individual performance I've seen for quite a few years. Spectacularly bad. Beyond that, I think Dortmund looked quite good. It caught my eye just how ropey Sevilla are actually these days. Like, it's, you looked at the starting lineup and it's like, it's very, please take my dinner money and thank you for this beating. Like, it's just kind of so little physical presence in their side. It's like, you would struggle to pick like a less imposing team than like Isco, Suso, Tellez, a 34-year-old Ivan Rakitic, a 36-year-old Jesus Navas, and 2 20-year-olds I'd never heard of at centre-back. The fact that they got spanked was not entirely surprising, but Jude Bellingham looked very good in that one, I thought.
Yeah, 4-1 that finished to Dortmund in Sevilla on Wednesday night. And straight after the game, Sevilla announcing the departure of their manager, Julen Lopetegui, which had kind of been in the works since the start of the season and has had some impact on the kind of atmosphere and morale of that side. Jorge Sampaoli is due to take over. Also midweek, by Leverkusen, decided they'd had enough of losing. They're no longer using their manager, Gerardo Suane. They got beaten by Porto. Excitingly, Xabi Alonso is the man they're choosing. Alonso, who spent 3 years as manager of Real Sociedad B and had a pretty terrific record there. Who's excited by that?
Well, I think he's going to do really well, and then the club will try and replace him with Gareth Barry next summer, so we'll see how that goes.
Interesting. You heard it here first. Bruges. I had a listener asking, can you please explain Bruges? They're the first Belgian team ever to win their first 3 games of a Champions League campaign. There they are. They've beaten Porto 4-0 away. They beat Leverkusen at home. And this week they beat Atletico Madrid 2-0. Crikey. Michael, how impressed are you by Bruges and their manager, Stoke legend Carl Hopkins?
Going into the group, I thought, well, that's a pretty evenly matched group, but I'd be fairly certain that Bruges will come bottom and it will be between the other 3 sides. So I was completely wrong on that. But yeah, I'll have to check them out in the next couple of games. I think it's quite a couple of kind of outsidery sides doing well. I mean, Sporting atop of Group D as well, ahead of Tottenham and Marseille and Frankfurt. And Benfica as well. I fancy Benfica might be a really good side. I mean, I think I'm right in saying until this time last week, I think they had a 100% record in the league and in the Champions League.
They won 13 straight games and then they drew at the weekend against Guimaraes and then drew 1-1 with PSG on Wednesday night.
Yeah, I saw the second half of that game. I turned over from Chelsea and they were very much holding their own against PSG. So, and also Salzburg are top of their group as well. So, I mean, often we go into the Champions League and I'm kind of thinking it's so difficult for teams outside the elite countries to compete. But that hasn't really been the case so far this year. I don't know if there's a reason for that. Maybe the pack schedule is... Would that benefit them? I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it's just a coincidence. But it's good to see.
Yeah, Giovanni van Bronckhorst of Rangers fame certainly saying after match day 2, well, there's no way we can compete with these clubs without hundreds of millions of pounds. But sites like Bruges seem to be giving the lie to that belief. Bruges, who, to explain your expectations for them, had lost before this season their previous 4 Champions League games and conceded 4 goals in each of them, at least 4 goals, sorry, in each of those 4 games. This time around, yet to concede a single goal and topping that group, as you say. Crikey. Inter Barcelona finished 1-0 to Inter I guess the big talking point there was a pretty extraordinary VAR performance. VAR, who had first off disallowed a Barcelona equaliser for handball. Then when late on in the game, Dumfries, with a pretty much equivalent move handled, took a long look at it, went, yeah, nothing to see here.
Yeah, I it was one of those classic things. I think the decisions individually, you could kind of see why they were made, but the combination of them, I think, is a little bit tough to get your head around.
It wasn't a good midweek for people who didn't like Pep Guardiola saying Joe Hart's kicking wasn't good enough for the modern game, because he presented Leipzig with a really good chance, like literally 30 seconds after they'd had a goal pretty harshly ruled out by our VAR friend. So it's rare you see hubris delivered that quickly in a football game, but there it was.
I also like that game because the combination of Celtic's goal, the assist to the scorer was Kyogo Jota, which was close enough to Diogo Jota for me to think it was quite funny.
Nice, nice. Also in action this week, Premier League sides with some mostly big wins. Let's get on to them and our league next.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
All right, Premier League, match day 10. No Friday night game, nor a Saturday lunchtime game. There is a Monday night game. It's Forest again, this time up against Villa. And there is, bizarrely, a Sunday 7 p.m. fixture, Everton, Man United. There's also a 4:30 Sunday afternoon clash, and it's a cracker. It's Arsenal against Liverpool. Woof. For Arsenal, a huge test of who they are. For Liverpool, 11 points back from the Gunners, but with a game in hand, it is an absolutely must-win affair if they get 3 points here and beat Man City next weekend. Who knows where they could be? What do you think? Imagine lots of you saw Liverpool's performance against Rangers. Don't you? You'll probably not be able to speak about it, though, because you'll be silenced as Trent critics.
Yeah, I mean, he can score free kicks. I don't think anyone's ever doubted he's very good at free kicks. He played an interesting role. I thought he was quite cautious early on, then was pushing forward a lot more. I mean, the interesting thing really was about Liverpool's system. They did change to just playing two central midfielders and played a fourth attacker. I think Klopp and Alexander-Arnold after the game both called it a 4-4-2, which was interesting. I would have called it more of a 4-2-3-1, but yeah, kind of same thing. I'm not sure they will stay the same for the weekend. I think they'll go back to the 4-3-3. I could be wrong, but I think the change of system was probably not just about their previous performances, but also about the fact they were up against a Rangers side who were playing pretty deep, playing a back five. It meant that their two central midfielders had to come a long way up to close down Henderson and Thiago, and that created space higher up the pitch. That said, both the goals came from set pieces, a free kick and a penalty, so they weren't at their fluent best. But yeah, obviously important for them to get the win.
I think one of the things about that system, it does have its benefits, but I thought Mo Salah still looked very just stationed too far from goal for my liking. In that, if you've loaded the centre with Nunez and Jota and Diaz, I think was kind of coming inside even more than Salah was. Salah was kind of picking the ball up in areas where he can hurt teams on the touchline. He can do typical winger things as well. But I just thought the congestion in the middle kind of meant that he was just slightly, on the fringes of the game at times. So whether that's in this system or, you know, reverting to a midfield three, the kind of the combination play with that, with Alexander Arnold on that side hasn't been quite at the level it has been in recent seasons. And yeah, that would certainly be my priority if I was Klopp at this stage, is getting Salah more involved in more central areas as he has been in more recent seasons.
Mm. In terms of the performance, I mean, positive night for Liverpool. We did see them previously beat Ajax at Anfield, and a lot of talk of them getting their mojo back, and then they were all over the shop against Brighton after that. So what do you think? How much are you seeing positive steps from Liverpool?
I mean, it was a win and a clean sheet, and that, I think the clean sheet's probably more important in some respects than the win. But as Jack was saying, I mean, the average positions of the players, Salah's right, stuck out on the wing, and the other three forwards are sort of clustered together in the middle. They pushed Tsimikas really high up in the game, which they're probably not going to want to do away at Arsenal. I mean, I don't want to be like Neville Southall to Michael Owen, but you were playing against John Lundstrom, who, you know, struggled in the Premier League a couple of seasons ago. So I don't think you can read that much into this. And I think they're going into an arena, if you want to call it that, or stadium, probably more accurate, where the atmosphere is brilliant at the moment. Everyone's really up for it. You know, we saw Tim said on Monday's show about the, you know, how impressive the atmosphere was ahead of the Spurs game. I think it will be as good for this one as well. So, maybe even better given it's later in the afternoon. You know, Arsenal haven't kept a clean sheet against Liverpool for 13 games in the league, which is a long time. But I think this is the first time in a long time I can remember, you know, Arsenal are going into this game as the definite favourites. And I think Liverpool will be, I think they'll be quite cautious early on, because if Arsenal score early, then it could get pretty bad for them.
Liverpool have actually won their last three visits to the Emirates without conceding a goal, but as you say, a lot of positivity around their hosts this time around. Michael, where do you think this game is going to be won or lost? Is it going to be a targeting Trent affair?
Maybe both the fullbacks, I would say. I think the way that Arsenal play down the flanks at the moment is quite impressive. They made inroads in the second half against Tottenham when White pushed on and Saka could come inside. And I'm not quite sure what Liverpool are doing at left back. Tsimikas has been playing a lot. I think he's okay. I'm not sure he's the strongest defensively. I think down the flanks will be the main issue. I mean, Gabriel Jesus has been fantastic this season, but I think maybe against these Liverpool centre-backs might have to play a little bit more of a decoy role. It's in the flanks, both flanks, I think, where Arsenal can cause problems.
Gabriel Jesus with a terrific record against Liverpool as a Man City player. Scored or assisted 6 times in 8 Premier League encounters. Numbers-wise, Duncan, am I right in saying that this is the Premier League's faster starters against the Premier League's slower starters?
Yeah, Liverpool would be almost in the relegation zone if only first halves counted this season. It's also the...
Where would Arsenal be?
Top.
It's probably a trick question because they're, top of the table.
Just top, everywhere. I mean, it's also, these are the two teams with the most touches in the opposition box this season. Jesus has got the most individually and Salah second. So they're both teams that, you know, progress into attacking areas with relative ease. And we've said this before on the pod, but of all the kind of big six clashes, this tends to be the most sort of guaranteed entertainment one. I can barely think of a bad game between Arsenal and Liverpool, which is funny because if you remember the late 80s, early 90s, these games were pretty rubbish. I remember Liverpool once playing 6 defenders away at Highbury in that grey kit that everyone mysteriously likes, even though they hate at the time. I'm looking forward to this. It's like it's the really good 4:30 slot. It's the best slot of the week statistically as well. So it should be a classic.
Can we hear more about that, please?
I did a study of kickoff times and then looking at different things like, you know, expected goals and shots per game and stuff, and basically 4:30 Sunday and 5:30 Saturday now are the best ones, and obviously they tend to get the best fixtures, but they are quite, you know, it's quite extreme how much kind of more exciting they are. So
right,
bring on.
What's the worst one, Duncan?
Tuesday 7:45, pretty much. But Tuesday and Wednesday nights, everyone thinks because they've been big sports night has confused them from when they were kids, but it's not true. They're low scoring and often not that good.
Is your sample size big enough for Sunday 7 p.m., which we have this weekend?
Sadly not. So that's going to be a huge boost to Everton and Man United players, knowing that they can really shape history on Sunday night.
Well, it kind of does tally with... I mean, footballers often say that they don't like playing early games, right? Because they have to eat weird food for breakfast and that performing in the mornings or at lunchtime doesn't really work, which I always think is funny because if you're an amateur Sunday league player, pretty much every game you've ever played is kind of before lunchtime at a weekend. So that's probably what's been holding us all back, just the kickoff time, really.
Arsenal, I've got a Thursday night fixture before the Liverpool visit. That's against Bodo Glimt. That's at the Emirates in the Europa League. A reminder, of course, that Liverpool, after this one, will be facing Rangers in Glasgow next week. And then it's Man City at Anfield the following Sunday. So a momentous 10 days or so for Liverpool. Speaking of Man City, they are just a point behind Arsenal, poised to take the lead if the Gunners should slip on Sunday and if they should happen to win against Southampton. City, of course, coming off that 5-0 against Copenhagen. Two goals for the big guy, the big fella. He came off at half times, not injury. Just keeping him fresh for the weekend. Duncan, his numbers?
I mean, they're stupid, aren't they? I mean, he's now only 27 players in Champions League history have scored more than him. He's scored now 1% of all Manchester City's Premier League and Champions League goals in their entire history. He's already scored 11 goals from inside the six-yard box this season, so I'm not sure what the all-time record for that is, but it's on, put it that way.
All right.
So, yeah, good. He's quite good.
19-12 in all competitions this season. 28-22 in the Champions League, which, as you say, that means only 27 players are ahead of him, and he's played only 20 games so far in the competition. It is remarkable. He's got a goal per game record in the Champions League of 1.27. Ooh. The other goal scorers, by the way, on Wednesday night were own goal, a penalty for Mahrez, and Julian Alvarez. City, across their last two games, have scored 11 goals. Haaland in the Premier League is on three straight hat-tricks. And next up, they've got Saints. But, Jack, before you come in with your nine goals lols, both Premier League meetings last season between Saints and Man City ended in draws. How did that happen? And could it happen this time?
I don't think it will happen again. No, I think City are perfectly positioned for this. I mean, they are just demonstrating that momentum is kind of a self-fulfilling thing because they have started so well in the Champions League. They can rest Kevin De Bruyne for a game like this. They can take Haaland off early. So as you know, as we get into the very densely packed schedule before the World Cup, they've already given themselves the gift of being able to do that, whereas, you know, the other supposed title contenders are not really going to have that luxury. So, yeah, the fact that Haaland has had a little rest coming up against a fairly fragile defence. I mean, Southampton, they're the kind of team who can still, you know, 2 or 3 months into the season, pick a player in defence that you didn't realise had signed for them. And that happened like last weekend. They've got Duje Cheletakar, the Croatian. Had no idea he was there. Just pops up, plays fairly averagely. And I think, yeah, they don't have too much protection midfield. They kind of lack a physical presence in there. So I can easily see Kevin De Bruyne leading City to another charge, basically. I can't really foresee anything else but a fairly commanding victory there.
Yeah, possibly Haaland with his fourth home hat-trick in a row. That would be remarkable. Is this going to be Ralf Hasenhüttl's last game with Southampton? That seems to be the word.
Yeah, it sounds like that's possible. And it's probably the worst fixture if you are trying to keep your job, isn't it? And I do think, I mean, we probably talk too much about the 9-0s, but there is something about Southampton, the way that they play, the way that they
What's
want
this?
To press. That they do seem to... I mean, apart from those results, sometimes they look very well organised, but I think they're just... They were so intense on pressing that if it does kind of collapse a little bit, it collapses completely. That said, I'm not sure they have been pressing as much this season. When I've seen them this season, I've been a little bit confused about what they're trying to do, to be honest. So, he's been there a long time. Am I right in saying he's the third longest serving after Klopp and Guardiola? That's off the top of my head. But, managers don't last long these days.
No, so very true. No wins in September for Ralf Hasenhüttl at St Mary's. And then they began October with that home defeat to Everton. Duncan.
It would be nice, I guess, to go out on a 9-0. You know, he survived two. Maybe in the lore of football, it would be like, well, the third 9-0 is what gets you, no matter who you are.
Third 9-0 is a dangerous scoreline.
It's a shame as well, because we're just getting into the kind of season when Hasnett will wear those creepy gloves again. And I always feel that's one of the worst sartorial choices in the Premier League.
How do you? Which was scarier, his or Vincent Tan's?
Oh, I think Vincent Tan, like, you know, being in a position of power at a club has a certain...
Right.
Well, Vincent Tan obviously introduced the concept of red being lucky, and then also ushered in the longest period of blue teams dominating title wins in the country's history. So, wow. Backfired.
Certainly did. Speaking of blue and red, what do you think, Michael? At the end of this weekend, will City be top of the table, having beaten Saints and seen Arsenal drop points against Liverpool?
I think Arsenal are playing really well at the moment. I do think they're quite strong favourites against Liverpool, which probably haven't said for a while. So yeah, I'd probably just about back Arsenal to stay top for another week, yeah.
Just about back Arsenal. All right. Let's hear what Michael Duncan and Jack feel about Chelsea, now on back-to-back wins under Graham Potter, and other topics too, next.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Sterling knows he's got Reece James over if he waits. He did wait. Nice and patient. 3-0.
All right, Chelsea, Wednesday night, 3-0 against Milan. Next up, Chelsea will be facing the other Premier League side to sack their manager this season, at the time of recording, Wolves. That's Saturday, 3 o'clock. Chelsea looked good against Milan.
Well, the first thing to say is I was really disappointed with Milan. You know, given all the excitement about their form in Italy, and I know they were handicapped somewhat by injuries. Teo Hernandez was a massive miss. They really lacked something on that flank.
I think the keeper as well, no?
Absolutely. But just bullied and out-muscled kind of all over the pitch, really. I think Chelsea showed a few signs of kind of Potterish play, pressing with intensity, and Milan just couldn't really live with them, I suppose. And so I would, in the same way that I would take Liverpool's improvement midweek with a pinch of salt, I would advise the same with Chelsea somewhat. Having said that, there were good signs here and there. I thought Reece James again looked very good with the freedom to get forward. Fantastic finish for the third goal. And yeah, I think there are small signs that there could be something happening at Chelsea. That, although I...
Wow, small signs. A 3-0 win against Milan, Jack. You're a tough crowd. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I'm going to be an even tougher crowd. I thought both sides were really poor. I wasn't impressed with Chelsea at all. I thought the goals that they scored just came from massive Milan errors. I mean, the first half, they couldn't defend set pieces at all. The second goal, I mean, Milan's centre-backs just stuck so tightly to their opponents, they got dragged all over the pitch. I can't work out what anyone's doing for the second goal. They're just all over the place, and there was a mistake for the third as well. But I must say, I thought Chelsea's passing in the first half was really poor. Koulibaly looked like he had his boots on the wrong feet. Chilwell, I thought, was poor. Loftus-Cheek, I think, just when he has the whole play ahead of him, I don't think he makes the right decisions. And Aubameyang, of course, got a goal, but I still think his link play for a top-class centre-forward is really poor. So, yeah, I mean, they won 3-0, and obviously three big points considering that the nature of the Champions League group. But for Chelsea against Milan, I was amazed how poor the quality was throughout that game, to be honest.
All right. Well, the return leg will be next week. All four teams in that group currently within just 2 points of each other, with Salzburg leading the way. Aubameyang getting goals in back-to-back games now. Reece James with a goal and an assist. Have some of that, Trent. Wesley Fofana with the other goal, but the excitement over that tempered very, very much by him departing Stamford Bridge on crutches after what looked like a very serious injury.
You see that so often, a player who goes down with a knee problem and then attempts to continue. As soon as it happened, I just thought, well, just go off now. You're already winning. You've got good enough defenders on the bench against a pretty average side that can, you know, shut up shop, get Azpilicueta on. And the fact that he tried to play on twice, actually, within the space of 5-10 minutes, I thought was, completely needless, especially as it wasn't, you know, a bang on the knee. It was a twisting motion when he put his foot down, yeah.
And also in the era of five subs, from the club's perspective, it's not like the manager should be like, well, come on, we want you to play on, don't want to waste an early sub. You've got enough subs to do it. Yeah, I completely agree.
Mm. Saturday then, it's Wolves for Chelsea. Wolves, who after some thrilling talk of Midlands managerial legend and cabbage collector Steve Bruce, now have seemingly settled on the less exotic Julen Lopetegui, who, as we heard earlier, has just been binned by Sevilla, but had previously done a terrific job for them when the squad wasn't being sort of sold off under his feet. For now, it's coaches Steve Davis and James Collins who'll be in charge for the game at Stamford Bridge. What are their prospects? Oh, and how excited are you about Diego Costa coming back to Stamford Bridge?
Very much so. He actually looked all right last week. I mean, he's not super mobile, but he still knows how to operate in the penalty area. And I think he'll relish coming up against Chelsea. And if, as Michael was saying, if they are as kind of, you know, slow as they were midweek, then he's got a chance. I mean, the counter to that is in this week's comparison, Wolves have currently scored as many Premier League goals this season as Miguel Almiron, which is that good in October? Doesn't seem good. So, yeah, they've not won a league game at Stamford Bridge since the Paul Daniels magic show started in the late 70s. So,
is that right?
How many goals have they scored? Not a lot.
Lovely, lovely stuff. Lovely stuff. Will they pull something out of their hat, though, for this? I do read that they are unbeaten in their last four meetings with Chelsea. But as you say, only one win in the last 15. They're the lowest scorers in the Premier League, of course. Were Diego Costa to find the back of the net, would he celebrate?
Oh, I think so. I think of all the players in world football likely to celebrate against a former club, I think he'd, he'd probably run down the road and find Antonio Conte and celebrate in front of his face, I think. But, yeah, I mean, Wolves, they got a big problem up front, of course, which is why they brought in Costa. But now they've got a problem at the back as well, because they had Nathan Collins was out suspended last weekend, so they played Ruben Neves at the back, which was an interesting experiment. He got a booking within about 15 minutes. And that was his fifth of the season in eight games. Yeah. So I was amazed by that. So he's out as well. So I honestly don't know who they're going to play at centre-back. Kilman and someone else. Who is it?
I think I'm right in saying that Johnny, you know, tiny Johnny, also played centre-back last week in a back three. So even before Neves was out.
Meanwhile, Connor Cody's marshalling the best defence in the Premier League. So...
Michael, you mentioned Antonio Conte. Meanwhile, his Spurs side are going to be down at Brighton a little bit later on that afternoon. Brighton, of course, the club that Graham Potter ditched for his fancy new Kings Road bow. Spurs, meantime, the one Premier League side that didn't win midweek. They had that 0-0 at Eintracht Frankfurt. Perhaps no shame in taking a point away at the Europa League champions. But after their disappointment against Sporting and after the 3-1, above all, in the North London derby, a bit underwhelming, this kind of run of results.
Yeah, they are struggling in terms of results and in terms of performances as well. I think the way that they play, they kind of rely on having two or three moments in transition or with quick passing moves. And when just one or two of those passes falls down, obviously the whole move falls down. And I think Tottenham's whole game plan falls down. I think that was the case at the Emirates. I thought their passing was really, really bad from Lloris in goal to Son. I thought could have played Kane in a couple of times and didn't do so. But they are lacking, I think they're just lacking connection at the moment between the lines. And I must say, I really like, obviously Son's got a great record. I think Richarlison's a good signing. But when Kulusevski's not playing, I think they're just such a worse team. I think he brings something completely different to the other two. He's good in tight spaces. He's good at drifting inside and acting almost as a attacking midfielder or a playmaker, I suppose. I'm not sure he's going to be fit for this weekend, and they don't really have an obvious replacement for him. But Kulusevski, I think, at the moment is their most important player.
Some worrying stats about Spurs on the road. They only picked up one win so far in six away matches, and no Spurs player has scored in open play in their last four games away from the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. This one is going to be at the Amex in Brighton. It's an Italian manager derby, of course, with Roberto Di Zerbi now in charge of the Seagulls. He didn't have a good record with Sassuolo against Conte's Inter, winless in four meetings, but that was very much then. Now, with Brighton, what tactically, you know, what do we expect from De Zerbi based on a massive 90 minutes so far at Anfield?
I thought that the key thing really was that he didn't change that much. I mean, they've been playing so well under Potter. It was a relatively similar shape. I think Estupiñán was the only change, I think I'm right in saying, down the left flank. So, yeah, I mean, obviously the main story would be Trossard getting in amongst the goals, but I'm not sure that was a tactical thing. I think it's probably a compliment to Potter that so far he's looked to continue with that system.
I mean, you can imagine Brighton having quite a lot of the ball in this. I mean, Spurs are allowing nearly almost 16 shots a game, which is the highest rate they've ever allowed in recorded Premier League history, so since like 03-04. And you can, it makes sense because they're trying to, you know, bring teams on and then counter against them. But as Michael was saying, it's not quite working at the moment. So, I think Brighton probably the favourites for this.
I think this could be the most interesting game, actually, just tactically. I think they play almost a similar system with a three. But then the fact that Brighton form, or so far, form like a boxing midfield. I mean, that's where Tottenham really have been exposed in terms of competing in the centre of the pitch. So I'm really looking forward to this game. It's the only televised game on Saturday, isn't it, in the Premier League? So,
it's also in that half five slot, which we know empirically is high quality. So, yeah, a treat.
So fruitful. Brighton currently fourth in the Premier League. They are 3 points behind Spurs. So could see them overtake Antonio Conte's side. They have beaten Spurs in each of the last three seasons as well. The Seagulls. So, interesting. Moving on, I'm extra intrigued by Sunday evening's Everton-Man United. Is it because of the unusual start time, possibly? Is it the sensation that the much maligned Frank Lampard might get one over Eric here? What do you think?
I'm personally quite sceptical about Everton's improvement. I think their results so far this season kind of sum up why football can be difficult to analyse, in the sense that in all eight games, there hasn't been more than a single goal between the two sides. Yeah, it's just fine margins every week. And you look at the expected goals. I mean, defensively, it's interesting. Duncan mentioned they have the best defensive record in the league in terms of goals conceded, but they've got the third or fourth most or highest expected goals against, which suggests that the goalkeepers are doing well and the opposition strikers are missing quite a lot of chances. So, I mean, they're certainly playing better than they were a few weeks ago, but I'm not quite convinced that this has been a significant improvement.
Okay, are you convinced by the significant improvement for Manchester United? I know you stand for Ralph Rangnick so famously. How do you feel about his replacement?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they couldn't have got much worse, although they did try with that defeat to Brentford. I thought they were really poor, actually, against City. I know it's the obvious thing to say because they conceded six goals, but I just don't know what they're trying to do without the ball, to be honest. I thought they just allowed City into their own third so easily. Bypassed in midfield. I don't think they really made any proper attempt to press out the pitch. So, yeah, a mixed bag so far. But I agree, this is quite an interesting game. And, Sunday night is a bit of a novelty, I suppose.
I wonder whether it could be finally time for Casemiro to make his way into the Manchester United side. I thought the decision not to play him against City was very misguided, particularly given that, you know, the other two midfielders were essentially number 10s. And I know Eriksen can play deeper, but physically he's not the most imposing. Against Everton, I think that will be a factor because, you know, Everton have got Onana and Gay alongside Iwobi in midfield, and their kind of power and energy, I think, will present a challenge to Manchester United if Ten Hag doesn't add a little bit more manpower to that area. So, I think this could be Casemiro o'clock, finally.
Michael, meantime, in midfield terms, what about Alex Iwobi and his transformation to kind of Everton's ideal number eight? Who saw that one coming, eh? Genius move from Frank.
Yeah, I wrote an article 3 years ago saying I think he should play centrally.
Wow.
I just think he's always been a player who has been slightly miscast. I think he kind of plays... He's at home narrower and deeper than what he was considered to be, which was a winger. He's never been spectacular. He's never been a great assister or goal scorer. But he's always been quite intelligent. He plays subtle passes that are quite effective. And I think players like that belong in the centre. So obviously Lampard himself was maybe the best number eight in the world at his peak, and saw those qualities in him. And yeah, that's definitely worked.
All right. Call him Alex. He will be, perhaps, from now on. Duncan, sorry.
No, I was just going to say that one of the reasons Iwobi's been so good this season is that he has actually added assists now as well. He's got three in his last four games. So for the first time in his career, he's kind of got a real end product as well, which I think is why he's really standing out. And probably, you know, could be a pivotal player against United with their, you know, up and down midfield.
Absolutely. United have only won one of their last seven Premier League meetings with Everton. And they're going to be coming off a trip to Cyprus, where they are taking on Ammonia Nicosia in the Europa League.
I mean, without wanting to go on too much about the kickoff time, I thought this was one of those games that had to be like early on, really early on a Saturday, because it was like potential crowd trouble kind of stuff. Maybe
Is
I'm wrong. Maybe
Everton Man United?
I thought that was one of those. Maybe it was Everton Man City that was a bit of a thing, but
I think the earliest kickoff ever in Premier League history is 11 o'clock, and it was a Man City Everton game, and it was because it was some Chinese company had bought, TV company had paid for it or something, so they put it on really early, so it was, you know, a reasonable time there.
Maybe some Australian broadcaster has bought this one.
Maybe. But like seeing goalkeepers with, you know, trying to shield a low winter sun. Always like right. Sander Vestervet always seemed like he was doing that. It's not right. So it's 7 o'clock on a Sunday is fine because it's going to be dark and the atmosphere will be good.
Yeah. Magnificent. Okay. Will Chris play? Will he play, Jack?
Chris being Ronaldo?
Yeah.
didn't realise you were such familiar terms. No, I wouldn't have thought so. I think as long as Ten Hag has the conviction and the authority to leave him out, I don't see a good tactical reason why he would include him at this stage, especially, you know, away from home, in a game that United might fancy, you know, winning more in transitions than in possession.
Would it disrespect his career? It could be the last time he ever gets a chance to play at Goodison Park.
Yeah. So. There you go. All right. Well, next up, a very special on this day and the other fixtures this weekend.
We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. According to their own survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Remember the last time you were hiring and how slow and overwhelming it was? Well, you don't need to go through all that again. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent. And because you listen to the Totally Football Show, Indeed is going to give you a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/totally. That's Indeed.com/totally. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed at Indeed.com. This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
6th of October, right? And on this day, in 2001, David Beckham scored that last-minute equaliser against Greece that qualified England for the World Cup and cemented his role as a national hero. For context, as there are probably, 21-year-olds who won't have been born when this happened, this was about as boyzone as it got. That's certainly a reference there. They'll understand at 21 years old. 93rd minute it was of England against Greece at Old Trafford. England needed to at least draw with Greece to automatically qualify, but Greece were leading 2-1. Oh my word, in the 93rd minute, England get a free kick around 30 yards out, up steps Bex at Old Trafford with the World Cup on the line. Boom.
And England may still be going to the World Cup automatically. And he is a lucky manager, and he deserves the goal because Beckham has virtually played Greece on his own.
Michael, where were you when you saw that?
I was in a pub in a little village called Claygate in Surrey.
Prove it.
You can't have been in a pub going age at that point.
No,
you?
I wasn't. I was allowed. It was early. It was, that must have been about a Saturday 5 p.m. I think I had to leave by 7 p.m. or something like that. It was very smoky. That's the thing I remember about that pub, which of course youngsters these days would be very confused by. But
it,
I actually did not.
Oh, go on. At 3 o'clock.
Even okay. Even at what? But it was a Saturday, and, wasn't it?
Yeah, live on BBC One.
The web of lies is suddenly stretching, isn't it?
What's this fictional village and Midsummer Murders that you're at?
That supports my point even more. I had to be out by a certain time.
Right.
Having youngsters
might
in the pub up until 5 p.m.
Yeah, I think 5 is the time.
Yeah, that is...
the 5 o'clock watershed, they called it.
It's back wriggled out.
Back to the point.
Yeah.
I did an article on Beckham's performance in this game a couple of years ago for The Athletic in our Reconsidered series.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. It's quite interesting because he takes about, I think, 10 direct free kicks in the game.
Huh.
And actually the pattern of them is all quite interesting. And I think plays into why the goalkeeper was so deceived. Because if you watch the free kick, the goalkeeper, he kind of just like crouches down, doesn't he? He doesn't really try and save it. And I think he's basically been bamboozled by the previous free kicks.
Bamboozled by Bex. Right.
Like a bowler doing a slow or a quick one to mix it up.
That's exactly the thing I said in the article. Exactly what I said in the article.
What John Motson said was that Beckham had virtually played Greece on his own. Of course, he still continues to do so much for the country now being, though, a Qatar. Anyway, 6th of October. Oh, sorry.
Just one thing that when I looked up this game to refresh my memory, and I laughed out loud thinking of Michael because Paul Scholes was booked in the 8th minute for what's described as a reckless late tackle on Karystaios. And I was like, maybe that does sound possible.
Well, if we hadn't qualified for that World Cup, I think it would have been Scholes' fault. I think he made the foul that led to Hamann's free kick. And then at the tournament itself, we went out, of course, to the Ronaldinho free kick. I think that was a Scholes foul as well. I need to check that first one. But I think if you go through the history of Manchester United and England, whenever they lose, it's because Paul Scholes has conceded a free kick 25 yards out.
Wow. Who was a more rubbish midfielder, him or Zidane?
Well, Zidane was a better player, so I suppose you have to say Scholes by that measure.
Scholes of Manchester.
Yeah. We're going to have to do a Michael Cox Iconoclast podcast series and do it soon. Right now, though, let me say that 6th of October is also the anniversary of another heartwarming event. 2020, 6th of October, it was a Tuesday that Mesut Ozil agreed to pay the full wages of Matt Scott Gunasaurus. Arsenal, you'll recall, had made him redundant because, air quotes, pandemic. But Mesut Ozil was having none of that. He stepped in and out of his own pocket, he paid Jerry Key. I'm not sure how to pronounce this. Jerry Key? Jerry Key's wages. Jerry Key was the man who... Sorry about this, kids.
Jamiroquai.
Yeah. He was the fella who had been wearing... Had been in essentially Gunasaurus for 27 years. And then just ruthlessly... I mean, like a big kind of meteorite streaking across his sky, Arsenal made him extinct. He's back in the role now, though, although it's a bit awkward because there's 27 people being Gunasaurus. There's a roster of them. Oh, sorry, there's not 27. I got confused with the 27.
What?
I got confused with the 27 years. But no, there's not. But there is a roster of people. I was thinking 27.
Yeah, that's...
if you got them all out at the same time, that'd be amazing. It'd be like Jurassic Park. I mean, slightly budget version. Well, Ozil himself.
You'd think they would just share the same costume, and out they would have a costume each.
Why not?
Just you'd want it. You own one, wouldn't you?
You want a squad? Grim. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially Midsummer Days. Those will get sweaty. May days. Ozil himself, ironically, was also subsequently made redundant, both by Arsenal and then Fenerbahce. You remember he went to Fenerbahce, his dream move. But he is still in Turkey. He's currently, I was going to say, playing for Başakşehir, the president's club. But he's only had 21 minutes so far this season.
I mean, it does show how far Arsenal come in 2 years, because like 2 years ago, essentially, their star midfielder was playing them off on Twitter quite regularly and like outwitting them. And yeah, things have got a bit better.
It was quite funny, that Gunnosaurus thing, because I think it showed the difference in kind of how we talk about football and how people involved talk about football. Because we just found the Gunnosaurus thing really hilarious. But I remember both Wenger and Paul Merson being asked about it on TV in kind of a jokey way. And both were genuinely quite appalled by what had happened. And Merson in particular was just on fantastic form.
He's part of it now. I mean, there'll be 30-year-old people, 40-year-old fans who have grown up with that dinosaur, and yeah, disappointing. I think it's poor by Arsenal. I really do.
Great dinosaur conversation about Gunnosaurus.
Wow. I mean, the picture of the team stood head down in the centre circle with Gunnosaurus also doing it is one of the most iconic football images I think that there is.
Well, anyway, back to the football. Monday night, last Monday night, this is, Leicester beat Forest 4-0. Previously bottom of the table, Leicester. They've now been replaced there by hapless Nottingham Forest, who've lost 5 in a row, conceding 18 goals in that run. Steve Cooper afterwards saying, "We're not a team." You'll have your own views on why that would be. He's still in charge, though, or it looks like he will be, for Monday night's next Monday night's clash, which will be at home to Aston Villa. Meanwhile, Leicester, with a bit of a spring in their step now, perhaps, will be at Bournemouth. What do you think about this game? James Maddison on fire on Monday night. Jack?
Yeah, I mean, this links back into positional changes in that Maddison is, it's almost more impressive that he's doing this from a position that I don't think is the perfect fit for his skill set. Like Maddison is the kind of player who, I don't know, if he was born 30 years ago in Pisa or something, a Serie A team would have built the whole side around him. He's like he's got a fantastic classic number 10 skill set, in my opinion. You know, through balls, flicks, free kicks, corners. Not necessarily a cyborg athlete, but very creative. And he's doing it this season basically from the right flank. He does get inside a lot, obviously, but you know, the way he's kind of adapted to that and got the best out of himself in recent months, I've been really impressed by. His free kick especially was just fantastic. I think everyone expected him to go to the other side and to have the presence of mind to go to the far post and to place it so perfectly. Great reward for a great performance. He could have had 4 assists easily, because Vardy missed 2 good headed chances, and Dewsbury Hall put a header wide after about 3 minutes from a great cross. So it could have been even more spectacular.
Oh, pretty good win, though, certainly for the team. Patson Daka with a lovely goal, the back heel, which was, I think, the 4th in that run, as the Foxes ended a streak of 10 Premier League games without a clean sheet as well, and got off the bottom of the table. They're at Bournemouth, who are themselves on a 4-game unbeaten run under their interim manager, Gary O'Neill. Forest, as I mentioned, are going to be against Aston Villa on Monday night. As I say, looks like Cooper will still be in charge for this game. The club appointing a new sporting director, Filippo Giraldi, on Wednesday. He's a former Watford sporting director. That's comforting. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, should help him get some new signings in.
Forest are breaking a lot of things, most notably their own chances of staying in the Premier League. But they have let in a goal from outside the box in each of their last 6 Premier League games, which is the longest run in Premier League history. So, I mean, have they not heard of XG? Do they not understand? Sort it out.
Villa are currently 2 points above the bottom 3. So,
I mean, without wanting to get too fixated on kickoff times, which I know I have mentioned a few times, it's twice in a row Forest have been on a Monday night. Mm-hmm. And I think of Villa as the most classic Monday night game. And I'm always intrigued by that, because it's always sides who haven't been in Europe, who aren't in Europe, because you can't put a team in Europe on a Monday night unless they're in Europe, I suppose. But it's also got to be teams that have got a big, you know, will get decent viewing figures. So a Forest now considered as kind of the new Aston Villa in that respect.
Or do they just have a quota to fill in terms of who they make their selections from?
Yeah, we are in Quotaville.
Of course. It's partly that, of course. But there's something on the... Duncan, have you done analysis on which sides get put on Monday night? I bet Villa, Newcastle...
Yeah, Villa, Newcastle up there. Palace as well. I mean, you look at this weekend's fixtures and Palace Leeds. If that had been on Monday night, I think everyone would have just nodded and gone, yeah, fair enough. So, yeah.
Are you excited by Nottingham Forest Villa? Is that a draw for you, Michael? I mean, a draw in terms of making you want to watch it rather than say...
It was a 5-5 draw a few seasons ago. I think Forest have still got a little bit of that new team, big team coming back up, cachet. And Villa, you know, they love showing Villa, Steven Gerrard and stuff, but they're two teams in not very good form and under a lot of pressure. So, which can make for a good Monday night game. You know, a few red cards.
I would be really, really excited about this fixture if it was the early 1980s.
Okay. You would be what age, though, Mike? You wouldn't be excited about anything.
Minus 5.
You'd be
something.
In a pub somewhere.
Probably, yeah.
Smoking tabs. Also this weekend, Crystal Palace taking on Leeds. That's Sunday, 2 o'clock. Not sure how you feel about that, Michael. West Ham against Fulham is also Sunday, 2 o'clock, but only one of them will be televised. And Newcastle face Brentford Saturday at 3, also not available to UK-based viewers. Which one will you miss the most?
Which one is on telly?
I don't know.
Is it Palace Leeds?
Palace Leeds is confirmed. So you can see Palace Leeds with Jesse Marsh back on the touchline, which is box office. Palace.
A lot of marshland in South London, so he'll be at home.
Palace, only goal difference outside of the relegation zone right now. Although, to be fair to them, they were a bit stiff by the referees last week and they have played 4 of last season's top 5 in their opening 7. In their 7 games? Have they only played 7 games? Oh, that's why they're down there, because they've got a game less than everybody.
Well, I was just thinking of Leeds and Selhurst Park, and obviously it wasn't against Crystal Palace, confusingly, but obviously Tony Yeboah, one of his two great Premier League goals, came on this pitch against Wimbledon. Will we see a goal as good as that in this one? Probably not, but something to think about or watch on YouTube if the game's bad.
Okay. Meanwhile, very much in the tree falling in the forest category, we've got West Ham against Fulham and Newcastle. Brentford, Jack?
Yeah, they're definitely happening.
They are happening.
I suppose for Fulham, it's you know, Mitrovic dependence factor. It's not clear whether he'll be back for this, but Carlos Vinicius, he of a brief stint at Spurs and used to be a centre-back till he was in his 20s, I would suggest is possibly not quite at the level of Mitrovic if they're missing their talisman. So yeah, I think if that's the case, they're going to struggle for a little while.
Right. While you're on YouTube, by the way, on Sunday, do check out a highlight from last time Fulham went to the London Stadium a couple of seasons back, when they had a last minute, I say last minute, it was the 98th minute, the chance to equalise against the Hammers. Ademola Lookman stepped up to the penalty spot with quite dramatic consequences. Newcastle, Brentford, these two teams drew 3-3 at St James's last season. That sounds like fun. Callum Wilson is back, he's scoring 3 goals in 4 appearances. Ivan Toney up against his old club. What do you think?
Well, Newcastle are in that strange position where they drew so many games and then they won last week. So now their record looks pretty good. And if they win this one as well, they'll obviously, you know, be in a pretty healthy league position and will have only lost one game all season. And that was a controversial one at Anfield. So it's quite hard to grasp how Eddie Howe's doing, because like they are making progress, but maybe not as much as they would have hoped, but then maybe they are. So I find Newcastle possibly the hardest team to get a kind of sense of this season.
Right. Only 2 wins so far this season, and yet with a victory this weekend, they could be in the top 4. They're only 3 points behind Brighton. Remarkable.
They're in that funny stage of a nouveau riche club, in that you watch them one week and it's, you know, Bruno Guimarães setting up Alexander Isak, and then you catch the end of the game a week later and it's like Jacob Murphy swapping passes with Jamal Lewis. So it's kind of that interim period when they've got 3 or 4, maybe 5 kind of players of the quality that will take them into newer heights, and yet they've still got you know, what is essentially a lower half of the table squad in many respects. So it's interesting to watch.
Mm. If only you could. If only you could.
Michael Cox's beloved blackout rule, isn't it? Yeah. Is that why you're interested in another kickoff time?
Don't get him talking about kickoff times again. That's
kickoff times are really important, honestly.
Well, I mean,
they make a big difference. As you know more than anyone, Duncan, they make a big difference.
What's your view on on MLS, where they sometimes just delay it 10 minutes to, you know, you've seen that? Often the kickoff will be actually 10 minutes after the stated kickoff time because they'll get a few adverts in before the game and stuff like that. So it's quite hard to keep a track of.
That's not good. So that's like when you're watching Sky and they say, at the weekend, Man United Liverpool will be on 3:30 on Sky Sports 1 rather than the actual kickoff time.
Right. Mm.
That annoys me in itself. So an extra 10 minutes on top of that would be just disastrous.
Mm. Mm. Well, ironically, all this talk of kickoffs, we're very much at the final whistle of this Totally Football show. We are scheduled to be back on Monday with our thoughts on the weekend. In the meantime, we were talking on Monday, last Monday, about the Athletic's special podcast on Taking the Knee, which features Carl Anker, Dan Barnes and Rashane Thomas. And if you stick around after the music stops on this one, we'll have a little excerpt from that. If you're interested. Very nice. For now, though, it's a goodbye from us all here. Many thanks to Jack Lang. Many thanks to Duncan Alexander and Michael Cox and producer Charlie. And you, the listener, do have a great weekend and look forward to speaking to you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following The Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
It's important to note that this is a societal issue. This is about things that are bigger than sport. But through the prism that we view it, we got to view, and you guys particularly, got to firsthand view what it's like to see football's response to this and to see how this issue was dealt with by sport. So to see something like this and to see so many teams and players incorporate this gesture and try and show a level of solidarity towards trying to stamp out racial discrimination. I mean, what was it like to see that? Because I just don't think we've seen anything on this scale before, right?
Me and Carl being one of the few black journalists at press boxes, I was phoning Carl asking, you know, what's your thoughts on this, bro? Do you feel like this should happen? Do you think that should happen? So we're having regular dialogue in terms of what's going on as well, because for us being young reporters, this is something new for us in terms of what we're seeing on the playing field. And with us being one of the few black journalists in the press box, well, in my experience, I'm not sure Carl's the same, but I had white journalists coming to me and asking, do you think this is the right thing? So that also showed the impact of what was happening on the pitch.
I also agree with Rashane in that I had much more senior people in the world of football ask for me my opinion on the taking the knee. It made me happy and sad. It was good that people who have been in football journalism and football media for as long as I've been alive were going, I am not the expert. Carl, I'm going to ask you to take the lead here. Or Rashane, I'm going to ask you to take the lead here. That made me happy. It also made me quite concerned that I was seeing people in their 40s and their 50s who've been in football media and in sports media for 35 years going, what is going on about black people being discriminated? And it was one of those real sort of, how do you not know this? How do you not have a stronger grasp of how systematic racism can affect black people in sports? I was once speaking to a very, very knowledgeable football person. We basically came to an agreement that at a certain level, not understanding how racism works makes you bad at your job, right? And I think when people say, why do we need to do this in a sporting sense? There's an old quote that often gets misattributed to Abraham Lincoln, which is essentially people are a lot more protective of their interests than they often are of their rights. And at a time of a pandemic where there was no cinema trips, very little outside socializing, but football was on, it was very important to do a gesture like that, because for a lot of people, football was their escape or their release or their one thing outside of work. And I can understand that if you were not thinking too much about police brutality and systematic racism affecting black people, you might be a bit annoyed that you're 1 or 3 hours in your weekend where you're not thinking about the stresses of the world. Someone's making a very overt, here are the stresses of the world and how they affect black people. Would you like to help? But also, I think the fact that we did that over and over and over and over and over again in what most people consider recreational playtime, and going, I know it's your playtime, but for 2 or 3 minutes, can we have a moment to just think about how systematic racism affects black people? That was really powerful. One of the more consistent criticisms of taking the knee from people who I do not agree with politically is that it's a meaningless gesture. It's forcing politics down our throat. And to that I say, it was never meant to be a meaningless gesture. It was meant to be a very powerful gesture. And unfortunately, due no fault of its own, but taking the knee became quite muddled and quite difficult. There were repeated instances where I was watching football games on television on UK broadcasters, and I'm listening to commentators saying, here are players taking the knee in their stand against racism in all forms. I'm going, no. Explain specifically why this gesture came about. Police brutality against black people, racial equality, systematic racism, not racism on an individual scale, but it does occur on an individual scale, and that is often what people are most adept at understanding. But the reason why people were so shocked in 2020, the reason why people felt the need to do something, the reason why, I mean, even the misguided attempts to post black squares on Instagram, the reason why those things occurred was because it became very, very clear that systematic racism and violence was occurring towards black people, and we believe enough was enough.
The Athletic.